back many years in AA. We enjoyed ourselves today. I told them, and honestly so, I don't know anybody that I would rather have spent St. Patrick's Day with than him and, of course, you, good AAs. St. Patrick's Day was always a big day for me, and if you knew my last name, you'd wonder why. But I can remain anonymous. I was telling Augie, who's in Iowa now out there, Augie was telling his last name. I have a last name kind of like Augie's. In fact, when I was at school, you know, I used to go to all the Polish dances and so on, and they thought I was a cousin or something. And those are really wonderful affairs. You ever go to Polish dances and weddings? Man, they really know how to live, you know. And but St. Patrick's Day, you know, was always a big day for me. And I can feel it coming. And I suppose that's true with the alcoholics out there, the AAs. Man, I get all excited about the day, you know, a week before. And I still feel it a week after. Not as I did in the days that I was drinking, you know. The Frenchman says, "Pierre, come home. Already you are drunk." 2 days, yesterday, and Pierre says, "You're wrong, I'm drunk 3 days, yesterday and tomorrow." See, well, that's the way it was with me. In fact, on St. Patrick's Day, I was judged when I was drinking, and that's what they generally refer to me as, the little judge. And the reason they call me the little judge is that I was sponsored by the big judge, Harrison, I suppose. Some of you have heard him talk, but on St. Patrick's Day, in my court, everyone was dismissed. I dismissed all the cases on St. Patrick's Day and then tried to beat the defendants out the door over to the Market Tavern, you know, to really get going. When I was judge, I had the reputation of being a kindly, sympathetic and understanding judge with the drunks. But as I look back now, I really didn't deserve that reputation, being honest as we must be in AA, because it's pretty hard to sit up there in the morning and give somebody 30 days for drunk, when you can't remember if you were with them the day before or not. They don't like that too well, you know. But anyway, I feel, I still feel this on St. Patrick's Day. It's a big day for me, and I know it's a big day for everybody. Well, of course, every day is a big day. You know, you wonder sometimes why you got drunk and what, when it was all over, and you wonder what the hell you did or why you did it, and you'd find it, well, it'd be your birthday and St. Patrick's Day and New Year's Eve and Christmas, and then there'd be Arbor Day and Groundhog Day and the day McKinley was assassinated, and it's really kind of hard to figure it out. How it was, Pat was reminding me of something I told him before. You know, I wasn't like a lot of you people that was drunk all the time. I was a periodic drinker, and the only time I get drunk is when I started to drink. And he was telling me about my cousin, my uncle, and when I'd be drinking, I'd stay away from him, and then when I'd quit drinking, I'd go back and visit with him. And one time, after one of these drunks, I went back to visit with him, and he said, "What the hell happened to you this time?" I said, "Geez, I don't know." I said, "I just stand there, and somebody asked me to have a beer." And he said, "Christ, it's a good thing you're not a woman, huh? Yeah, that figured out pretty well, too. I was thinking I talked down to the penitentiary, Augie, a couple weeks ago, and one of the convicts came up and said that he had broke into the office building where I have my office, and he had gone robbed many of the places, and he was in my office, and I know he was in my office because he described where the safe was and all. But he said he looked at my name on the door, and he'd heard me speak when he was then in the reformatory in Anamosa, and he thought I was a pretty good guy, so he didn't steal anything from my office. So there's a bonus that you don't ordinarily think of. I think of another extraordinary bonus, you know. Well, you know how it was when you're drinking something, say, come on, and you never said where you're going, and then you just went, and that carries over even after you quit drinking. So one night in our rooms, someone asked me to come, and I went along, and here they were moving a piano from the first floor down into the basement, and I was holding out a rope there, lowering the piano down this stairway, and the cops came by and shined a light in our faces, in mine included, and said, hello, Judge, and I said, hello, Officer. He didn't seem surprised what I was doing, but anyway, when we got it down there, we found that the stairway was too narrow to turn the piano to take it into the rooms. So one of the smarter alcoholics said, well, we leave the piano out here. And somebody said, well, what if it rains? Well, they said, we'll hold an umbrella over the piano player. And so we left it there anyway. But that night, the great miracle happened. One of the greatest miracles in AA, somebody stole the piano. So, we never had that to worry about, you know. And then, of course, was the old days when you were drinking, you didn't eat, you know, And that wasn't good. In fact, I was reading just recently some health, education, and welfare fellow was giving a talk on how to stretch food. I think the subject was how to stretch food. And he said Solomon had 1,000 wives and fed them well. And some drunk in the audience said, never mind what he fed them, what did he eat? That's kind of interesting, too. You know, you wonder, I often tell Pat when we have such a nice audience, particularly such at an open meeting, you know, we'd like to quote the Shelley, Keats, Byron, and so on. The only thing I recall is something I read in Shakespeare, and he said it, referring to drink, it provoketh the desire but taketh away the performance. And I want to tell you, Shakespeare knew what he was writing about. But anyway, we're here, and I think of a lot of nutty things that have nothing to do with it. For instance, when I went to the academy many years ago, we were taught Caesar's Gallic Wars. And the professor said, if you don't remember another thing, you must remember this. Horum omnium fortissimi sunt Belgae. Of all these, the bravest were the Belgians. I remembered it all these years. I don't know why the hell I should be remembering that, you know. I remember, Augie, one time during the war, I was going out to talk out in Waterloo, and I stopped in a Winthrop, a little town, and I went in the men's room. And over the place there that the men use as a sign, it says, in the event of an air raid, jump in, nobody's hit it yet. I can remember that. And for St. Patrick's Day, 17 children had Mrs. O'Brien. She's doing fine, but the stork is dying. But when it comes to remembering the things that I should know, then I wonder. I wonder about that. And I wonder, too, I was thinking, Pat was talking about the time I was over in Dwight. And we had a great meeting over there. And at that time, I was, I don't think I was the regular speaker. I think I was pinch hitting for the governor, who's now the senator from our state, who is also an alcoholic and also an AA, a great AA. You've all been reading of him, I'm sure, in his $300 million bill that he was successful in having passed for the rehabilitation of the alcoholics and so on. But anyway, I was thinking then that they say politics makes strange bedfellows. Well, I suppose AA makes strange bedfellows, you see. Years ago, there is an old limerick entitled, that went something like this: Boston, the home of the Cape and the Cod, where the lodges speak only to the cabots, and the cabots speak only to God. And Westbrook Pigler paraphrased that. And he wrote it and said, Boston, the home of the Cape and the Cod, where the lodges speak only to the cabots. And he had learned that one of the cabots had married a Polish girl. So he said, Boston, the home of the Cape and the Cod, where the lodges speak only to the cabots, and the cabots speak Polish, by God. So that's the way it is with us in here. We're all equal. We're all suffering from the same illness. The illness is a serious illness. It's a terminal illness. We know that we will die as alcoholics. We know that it's the third major health problem in the country today, and that's why this appropriation was finally passed at the insistence of Senator Hughes. And but it's a strange thing, you know. It's as Pat read here from the big book. They say it's a baffling and insidious disease. Well, it's even more than that. Someone has said the trouble with trouble is it starts out like fun. And that's the way this illness starts, you know. The alcoholic, I'm sure all of you were like I was, and my good wife is with me tonight, and she remembers. In fact, it wasn't, it was just a matter of a couple of weeks ago when a couple, a very good friend of mine and his wife, came down from Madison, Wisconsin to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary with us. And we went over to his sister's home with his other brothers and sisters and their spouses. And they started to drink, you know how it is, about 6:30. And they kept drinking, of course, and then they kept recalling about some of the wonderful times we'd had, you know. And they weren't recalling, of course, most of them had moved away when I got to the point where I was having a lot of trouble with the drinking. But then, you know, the longer they talk and so on, the more you sometimes wonder if you really were as bad as you thought you were, if you really were an alcoholic, you know. They were recalling the pleasant things, and then they got out the old Katie and the old K cane, and I did the old dance that I used to do, and a couple of gals there, and we did the Charleston, and so finally about 9:30, after 3 hours of this, they said we'd go and eat. Well, I thought, thanks be to God, we're now going to eat. And we started out to eat. Well, on the way out the country we were going to eat, by God, we went by a fire. It was a hell of a fire. So they're all full, and they all had to go to the fire. So then it's about 10 o'clock, and I'm standing around there with mud up to my you-know-what. And I wonder, what in the hell I'm doing here? You know, they're all drunk, and they're all hanging on me and down the old buddy and old pal, you know. And then we finally got out the other way. Well, we didn't eat till about a quarter to 12, you know. Well, then you must thank God, of course, that you're able to see yourself as others see you and so on, and still not drink and still come home and so on. And, of course, the times they referred to were true, and I had a lot of pleasant times when I drank. But unfortunately, I passed over that invisible line from controlled drinking to uncontrolled drinking, and it took me a long while to know I was there. I knew that booze and beer and all the rest of it was bad news for me long before I quit drinking, long before I got into AA. But I used to think, well, now why can't I go in there and have a couple, you know, not a drink, but a couple of drinks, then go home like the rest of them. But unfortunately, I couldn't get that job done, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, although I had tried many ways of quitting drinking. I was telling Pat about some of the places I was to take what they were treatments, what they call a conditional reflex treatment, so it's really a cure, but it was a nice way of putting it, and being in the sanitarium in the hospital and so on. But I never found out until I got into AA what was wrong with me. And I came into AA in a real, circuitous, anonymous way. God's been good to me, and I've been sober a long while. And when I came into AA, it was so anonymous you couldn't find it. So I had read an article in the Argosy magazine that I'd picked up, and I say that advisedly. I probably picked it up, too, if nobody was looking. I sure as hell didn't pay for it. And, you know, like the old days, you'd be punching the punch board, you know, and bartender went and looking and sit and let them go down the spit tube, you know, or I'll take them back in the men's room. And it's awful hard to get them back out of there. But I was just as foxy, or thought I was just as foxy as the rest of the guys. I remember one time when I was judge, I was playing a little damn machine I was playing quarters in this machine, and it was supposed to be a nickel machine, but I was playing quarters, and I wasn't as drunk as the bartender, Timothy O'Regan, thought I was, and I won. So I told him that I get five times what it says on the machine, and he says, no, he's going to pay me on the nickel basis. So I picked it up, I remember it was on a glass top cigar case, and I picked it up and I said, are you going to pay me? I was going to let it go through. See, I thought that was a fine thing to do. So he said, wait a minute, I'll pay you. And so he did. Well, anyway, we all went through these times and these pleasant times and the bad times. And I'm not going to give you a drunkologue of my drinking, the little thing back there. Now, I must tell you now, she seldom is with me anymore. She's heard me so often, she gets tired of coming, see, but she's with me today. And I really had some, I was telling the kids, so I guess I can tell you. She's a very lovely, fine woman and how she married me, Pat, I'll never know. But anyway, there is something real special going on. And she said, please don't drink today. And I said, no, I won't drink today. Well, unfortunately, I did drink, you know. Possibly, you know, like you do. Well, she thought I was going to drink, so what the hell, I might as well drink. You know, you're real nuts, you know, when you weren't drinking. Somebody asked you to have a drink, and you think, well, maybe I better take a drink. Don't want to hurt his feelings, you know. Well, you always could figure some angle. Well, anyway, I came home, stewed, and this lovely gal, I never forget, I think that's one of the things that helped me quit drinking. And, of course, you have to know that my mother was Irish, and, anyway, when I came home this night, I remember she looked at me and she said, you shanty Irish drunken son of a bitch. And I never dreamed by God that that woman would ever say that. So anyway, I thought the next time I got stewed, I'd get even with her. So all day I'm drinking, but I'm thinking, boy, I'm thinking that when I get home tonight, we're not going to have a recurrence of that. So when I got home this night, and you have to know that her dad was an undertaker to appreciate this story. So I got home and I said, I have today changed my will. That's such a large estate. I said, I've changed my will, and I said, the principal change I have made in my will is that your old man ain't going to pay me. That made a lot of sense, too, and that made a lot of points, too, with me, it seems. Well, anyway, those were some of the things that happened, and there were a lot of other things that happened. Some of the things that happened were that I drank, and I wasn't the oldest guy some 26, 27 years ago in AA. But by the time I came into AA, I had drunk to the point where, according to the rites of my church, they had prepared me for death three times, you see. Three times. And you talk again about boni that we receive. I remember one time they thought I was going to die, and I thought I was going to die, and my mother was a very wonderful woman, got the priest over, and he said, you'll have to make a general confession, you see, Pat. And I figure, you know, Pat, there's no time to be choosing up sides. So I made a general confession, and I got well, as you can see. And then I met him one day, and he said, now that really didn't count. Man, I hadn't really intended to say that much, you know. But that'll be a good thing, Pat. Now, if I get off this thing, you have to tell me where I was, because I do that once in a while. I get in the middle of something, I don't know where the hell I started. But I think that'll be a good thing when they change that part of the church, you know, where you just can make a general confession. I'll be in favor of that rather than going into specifics, you know. In fact, it's kind of a carry over there. Maybe it's because I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. God, I'm a grandfather. You wouldn't think now a young-looking guy like me be a grandfather, but I find myself still going in, you know, bless myself, say, man, it's been a month since my last confession. Since then, I had two impure thoughts. Boy, that's really let yourself off the hook, isn't it? But anyway, now I don't even know where the hell I was standing. Yes, I know. Well, anyway, the priest said I must come back now, and he said we'll go into that in detail. Well, man, that's what I didn't want to do, go into that in detail. But again, God was good to me, because the priest died. So I didn't feel any obligation to anybody else. I was dealing with him. Well, we must go along here now, and I was like you fellas when I drank. I tried many ways to quit drinking. I remember one time bought a red car. I was a judge. I had a real bright fire engine red car, and I thought, I won't park that in front of a club or a tavern, any place, you know. And boy, I did. That's one way you won't quit drinking, buying a bright red car. But it was a remarkable car. It was a Plymouth. And she'd go down off the road, you know. And boy, it could take off those, you know, those boxes, you know, those mailboxes, rip them right off, you know. In fact, one time, that was when I was judge, I came all the way through town with a mailbox on the bumper of my car. And I remember one time, boy, I was waking up in strange places under strange circumstances. I woke up one time in bed with all my clothes on, shoes and all. I couldn't figure out where I was. And finally dawned on me, I was in the Trappist monastery. Boy, it's a wonder they didn't have to reconsecrate or rededicate or do something to that place. And, but anyway, the man who'd been working with me, a very kindly man, he was outside the door that morning. I went out and he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. I said, I don't remember. I walked out here, or I came in a cab, or I drove out. I don't know how I got here. Well, he said, why'd you come? And I said, well, I've been thinking if I made a retreat, maybe that'd help me, you know, and maybe that'd be the source. Well, he said, what do you care what the rest of it? You stay. No, I said, I gotta go. And he said, do you want a drink? Boy, there is a fellow that was really an understanding man. And I said, do you think you could get one? And he said he could. And he got some of the old monk's wine. And man, I tell you, that's good, you know. I often think, and I like my lovely wife, and she's a wonderful gal. But she never really quite understood the illness part of this program, you know. Even today, we walk down the street, nice warm summer day, you know, you go by a tavern, and she says, phew, and that smells terrible. I've been around a long while in AA, but it still smells good to me, you know. Especially in the morning when you got that close, boy. Then you knew you were going to live, you know. You got a little of the hair of the dog that bit you, you know. I remember I had a lady in the office the other day, and her husband was just in the peace. They had a whole kind of a summer resort. Oh, I was always a great guy. I was always the last guy to go home, you know. I often thought of that. They'd have free beer in the tent out there. I'd never be out with the free beer. I'd be in buying hooch, you know. And but anyway, everybody's going home with this old Justice of the Peace and me. And anyway, I went home and little thing woke me and said, you go down and you take that livestock back wherever you got it. Well, I had no idea what the hell she was talking about. And then it all came back to me. I'm sitting there with Red Sullivan, Judge Sullivan, and I'm telling him how crazy I am about cats, you know. Well, geez, everybody wants to get rid of cats. And I drove home. God, I had them on my shoulders and on top of my head and everything. Then I had to take those damn things back and tell them that the kids weren't big enough, you know, and that I'd come back and get them a little later. Well, anyway, those are then, of course, going on the wagon. And then I think, well, I'll move away. And I thought of moving away permanently. In fact, the little thing, I forget when I went to the Army. I went down to the Army to be examined, you know, and geez, the first guy that looked at me, he said, you're going to lie down. I guess he thought I was going to blow up. My old sponsor, that's quite a reputation. That's quite an honor. And my sponsor said I had the deepest barroom tan of any man he ever sponsored. So anyway, I came back. And I never forget the she looked at me. I thought everybody would be so damned happy that I was back, you know. And boy, if you ever saw a sad look, it was my lovely wife when I returned. Because at that time they needed men so bad you kept right on going. She hoped I'd keep right on going with the maximum amount of insurance right up to the front and get shot. That'd be the end of the whole damn deal. And everybody would be happy about it. Well, going on the wagon and going away, I used to think, well, I'll change my clothes and I'll leave my clothes down the riverbank. And then I'll take off. And I used to think there was a place up near Caswell, Wisconsin, where I used to go fishing. I thought, well, I'd drive my car in front of the Zephyr up there where she's moving about 85 miles an hour, and that'll be it. But I never did those things. And in fact, when I went down to, after I had written to New York, and this fellow answered my letter, and I went down, I used to go to the meeting house telling Pat in Des Moines, which is 200 miles from my town, 400 miles round trip, every week I meet it. And would have been glad to walk it for what it was doing for me, because I was staying sober. And I remember when I was coming home with my wife, I told her, I said, if I lived down there with those guys, there weren't many, they had about six in the whole state then. And I said, if I lived down there with those guys, I could quit drinking. And she said, we'll move down. She'd do anything, you know, and said, we'll move down. So next time I went down, I told her. I said, we've been talking it over, and I think I can quit drinking if I come down here, so I'm going to move down. No, he said, kiddo, you got to go back and lick it where it licked you. So recently in the, that was talking of this in the geographic cure, recently in the Chicago Tribune, when John O'Hara died, disappeared, and I think this says much more eloquently than I that this geographic cure isn't going to work for any of us, because we take ourselves with us wherever we go as alcoholics. But this is much more dramatic and much more poetic than I could put it. Death speaks. There was a merchant in Baghdad who sent his servant to market to buy provisions. And in a little while, a servant came back, white and trembling, and said, Master, just now when I was in the marketplace, I was jostled by a woman in the crowd, and when I turned, I saw it was death that jostled me. She looked at me and made a threatening gesture. Now, lend me your horse, and I will ride away from this city and avoid my fate. I will go to Samara, and there death will not find me. The merchant lent him his horse, and the servant mounted it, and he dug his spurs into its flanks, and as fast as the horse could gallop, he went. Then the merchant went down to the marketplace, and he saw me standing in the crowd, and he came to me and said, Why did you make a threatening gesture to my servant when you saw him this morning? That was not a threatening gesture, I said. It was only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him in Baghdad, for I had an appointment with him tonight in Samara. So you see, when we're going to take this geographic cure, when we're going to go away, it isn't going to make any difference, because unless, of course, we have all the qualifications that Pat read you here that go to make up the fine AA. But we know, too, that... Although this is a terminal illness that we're all suffering from, we know that there are only three outs for the alcoholic: out of your mind, which is insanity, out the window, which is suicide, or complete sobriety. We know that we're not alone. Years ago, when I came in, Al alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous, everything attached to it had such a stigma that even the drunks wouldn't associate with it. But it's different now, you see. Through the great coverage that we received with the news media, through men like the now senator and the judge and all these other great men, particularly that you had in originally in Chicago, the great Clem Lane, head of Chicago News, Roy McLaughlin, who was the executive vice president of the American Broadcasting Company. And I remember when I used to visit Roy in his office, take him to the window, and he'd show me the billboard where he was when the AAs picked him up. He had lost everything. Katie, his wife, his job, everything. And he went from there up to the executive vice president of the American Broadcasting Company. And the great Judge Dewey, and all the great guys, the guys that sponsored Pat Cronin, who started AA in the Twin Cities, and from there it fanned out into Minnesota and up through the whole northwestern Canada. So now we find that, and these are true, and we're not dry. My sponsor told me that if I didn't enjoy myself in AA, I wouldn't have to come back. He told me that maybe tomorrow we get drunk. Today we don't drink. Maybe tomorrow we get drunk, but not today. He told me that I should enjoy myself. And he said, you can quit drinking and be happy about it. I thought, well, I may quit drinking, but I'll never be happy about it, you know, because I spent all of my free time and too much of my working time drinking. But I found that to be true. And I found out, too, that I wasn't alone and that I didn't have to feel sorry for myself because I'm an alcoholic. The statistics are such that when we walk down the street, one of 12 persons that we see on the street is an alcoholic. The unfortunate part is that the public generally equates the alcoholic with the skid row bum, the evil-smelling, bleary-eyed, flush-faced fella. And for that man, we don't now play God with him, nor do we take his inventory, nor do we hear his confession. We, the former clowns and fools and drunks ourselves, couldn't now play God with any man. But unfortunately, the public, you see, equates the alcoholic with the skid row bump. And there are only 3% of the alcoholics down there. The rest of them are all in the other upper echelons of society and in the other businesses and the other trades and professions and so on, you see. And I think what is even a more startling statistic is the fact, and when I talk to high school groups, I tell them this, that one of 17 kids in high school, one of 17 kids in high school will in a matter of 3 years become an alcoholic, you see. So we're not alone. We're not alone. There are a lot of alcoholics in the world. They're like the poor people. God must have loved them because he made so many of them, and there are a lot of them. Now, one time when I was talking to the highway patrol, I told them the story. If you're walking down the street one day and a man falls down, the crowd gathers and they say, "What's wrong with this man?" They'll say he's had a heart attack, a stroke. Immediately they'll call the doctor and get an ambulance and take him to the hospital. You're walking down the street another day, or perhaps the same day, a man falls down and the crowd gathers and they say, "What's wrong with this man?" They'll say he's drunk, he's an alcoholic, and they call the cops. And yet the man lying there in the drunken, or the woman lying there in the drunken stupor, is infinitely sicker than the man lying ill with the stroke or the heart attack, because there are too few people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous who understand that he is a sick person and he can be helped. You know, we all like poetry. I'm sure you're like I am. I love poetry. I was thinking, you know, before when I said the trouble with trouble is it starts out as fun. But you know, Kipling, and I know it, and I wish I'd have brought that along. I cut something out and I used it the first time at the penitentiary the other day when he describes a drunk, and boy, if he wasn't there, then, my God, I don't know anybody that was. But I often thought that Kipling, when he wrote this, had in mind the alcoholic. Now, Kipling, in his Barrack Room Ballad, when he tells the story of Matten, the hunter, who was about to shoot the bear, and the bear held up his paws, and Matten lowered his gun, and then the bear came across with his claws and removed his eyes and nose and lips. And in telling of that, Kipling says, when he shows his seeking quarter with paws like hands in prayer, that is the time of peril, the time of the truce of the bear, eyeless, noseless, and lipless, seeking a dole at the door, Matten, the old blind beggar, he tells it o'er and o'er, fumbling and feeling the rifles, warming his hands at the flame, hearing our careless white men talk of the morrow's game, but over and over the story ending as he began. There is no truce with Adam's axe, the bear that looks like a man. And so it is with us. For us, one drink is too many, and 1,000 are not enough. Now then, we say we're anonymous, we say we're alcoholic, and of course as an alcoholic we're a paradox. And again, I'm going to read from something that a friend of mine, old Rip, wrote. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard Rip. He's a real wonderful AA who devoted his entire life, after he got into AA, his entire life as an apostolate with working solely with alcoholic priests at Orion, Michigan. Now he's in Rochester, Minnesota. Rip wrote the photocrime series in the Look magazine. Hannibal Cobb was his detective. He wrote the Minute Mysteries that appeared in a chain of 90 newspapers. The mystery would appear on the front page, and then the answer would be back in the one. And his wife told me that he had a 2-day deadline, which he never made, and he'd be typing these things out. 2 days late, she in a cab with the typewriter on his lap and she holding an ice bag on his head. And they got so bad that someone finally wrote in and said, these are well-named Minute Mysteries. I don't even understand the solution. But he was a real great guy. He's a real great guy. He's still around. I was the treasurer of his first when he first started, and we had many, many happy times. Wonderful guy, most eloquent man, I suppose, in or out of AA. Finally, he lost his Minute Mysteries in different newspapers because of his drink. He lost the one in the Chicago Tribune by going in and telling Colonel McCormick that the policy of the paper was wrong. Well, naturally, he ain't going to continue publishing his Minute Mysteries, you know. But Rip wrote this, and I think it's a very beautiful thing, and it won't take long, and I'm going to read it to you. Called An Alcoholic Paradox. The alcoholic is many things to many people, including himself. He is the world's supreme paradox. We knew what we were going in the bar for. We were hunting for freedom from fear, and we found only desperation in the bottle, yet we drank. We searched frantically for courage in the glass, looked up and saw cowardice in the mirror, yet we drank. The alcoholic knows better than anyone in the world that the whiskey which makes the poor alcoholic rich in fancy for an hour makes the wealthy drunkard poor in fact for life. The alcoholic drinks not because he would, but because he must. He does not take a drink before dinner to ease the tensions of today, no. He will knock off a pint before bedtime to escape the pressures of tomorrow. Your alcoholic is in love with life, yet how often he commits suicide. He struggles desperately to be free and rushes headlong into a self-made prison. When he is sober, he would like to be drunk, and when he is drunk, he prays to be sober. Your alcoholic will get high in the evening knowing that he will be low in the morning. He thrills to the beauty of life, yet he seeks the ugly and sordid in existence. And such is the strange paradox of the alcoholic, that the only way he can feel better is to drink that which makes him feel worse. The alcoholic seeks to inflate his ego in the provocative wines of Bacchus, and he succeeds only in shriveling his soul in the bitter gall of remorse. And watch him. He will start all his bouts with the dignity of a king and wind up his debauches with the fawning of a clown. And so he goes on his incredible, incomprehensible, paradoxical way, leaving in his wake as human wreckage that which he cherishes most. Down the road of alcoholic oblivion, he stumbles and staggers until he drowns himself in a 2-ounce glass of whiskey, or, by the grace of God, may find himself in the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we have here, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now this we say humbly, and in no manner boastfully. But this we say, that no man or no woman, regardless of how much or what he or she has been drinking, once he or she knows of Alcoholics Anonymous, can ever again honestly say that he or she can quit drinking. Because the lives now of more than a 500,000 men and women throughout the whole world will belie that person's very words. And it's done just as Pat has read to you earlier in the opening of the meeting. That's the way it's done. You say you're an alcoholic, which is saying you're a sick person. We do it anonymously. We do it one day at a time, not forever, but for today, one day at a time. We come to the meetings. Once a week, we come to the meetings. Then we help another guy or another gal. Now, who do we help? Outside of Boys Town in Nebraska is this statue showing the boy of 12. Carrying the boy of 9 who's asleep, and obviously a heavy burden underneath that statue, says, "He ain't heavy, Father, he's my brother." Now, who's our brother? Our brother is not every man or woman who drank as much or more than us, if that can be imagined. But our brother or our sister is every man or woman who wants to quit drinking. Because we have learned, paradoxical as it may seem, in order to keep this great gift of sobriety, we must give it away. And we get the great gift of sobriety not through anything that we have to do. We get the great gift of sobriety from what we refer to in here, because there are men and women of many religion and men and women of no religion, the power greater than ourselves. I think it's a sad commentary, and I don't intend to change the world. But when I hear some of these ding-a-ling so-called songwriters, you know, having written and published and being aired, such as Jesus Christ Superstar and so on, you see, those people never had the trouble we had, or they wouldn't be banding that word about them. I remember one time I spoke at the University of Iowa during Religion Week. They had a minister, a priest, a rabbi, and I appeared anonymously from Alcoholics Anonymous. And when it was over, the dean of the School of Religion called me off and he said, I should be perhaps ashamed to tell you this. He said, I'm a man at the cloth. But he said, of all the men who spoke here, none showed the deep faith that you have, referring to AA. And I said, none of those men had the difficulty that we had. We who spent thousands of dollars in drinking, thousands of dollars in trying to get sober, and then have come into Alcoholics Anonymous, got sober for free, surely we're the great modern day miracle. We know that in our, and the, when Hemingway said it's the millennium of the untalented, boy, he knew what he was talking about, and that sure as hell goes for these songwriters and a lot of these other ding-a-ling guys, in my opinion. But we know in our most drunken moments that we couldn't cause the sun to rise in the morning and set at night. The seasons should change from spring to summer to autumn to winter. So that's the power that we rely on. And in the morning, do it as you like. I do it the way my sponsor told me. I get down on my knees and I say, please God, keep me dry today. I can't do it alone. Then I ask Matt Delvitt, you see, to talk to God for me. Now you say, who's Matt Delvitt? See, and I'm not putting on a pitch for Matt Delvitt, but I wear Matt Delvitt's medals. And the reason I wear Matt Delvitt's medal is because Matt is the saint of drunkards, you see. And he's always had plenty of time to listen to, you see. There aren't too many guys that are going to say, this is my pal, this is the saint of drunkards, you see. But I know that works. And not only in here, I know another medic, my daughter. When she was graduating the university, I had difficulty with something. She's medical technology. And when we got over there that morning, she said, everything's fine. She's going to pass. She's going to get her degree. And I said, I knew you were. She said, you did? How? I said, I've been talking to Matt, my friend Matt Delvitt. I had two boys in Rochester at the same time. Two boys. One fella, I'd had him at the University of Iowa, the fella that's named for my sponsor, who is a senior now at the University of Notre Dame. That's how long I've been in AA. I'd had him all over, 7, 8 different doctors. I had him down at the University of Iowa. The doctor down there told him he had a malignant tumor, he'd be paralyzed until he was 16 years old. I had my other boy up there who had a tumor on the inner, on the nerve from the inner ear into the brain. They were both there at the same time. And boy, I was scared. I mean, I was really scared. And I'm putting on a pitch here, and I don't want you to think I'm putting on a particular pitch for Catholicism. I'm not, because I had a great pal who's one of the, really one of God's noblemen, who's a Presbyterian minister. And he and I were great pals, and we worked together in AA until he was killed in an automobile accident a year ago. But I called him and I said, he lived in a town south of me, and I'm about 200 miles from Rochester. And I called him and I said, I'm worried about my boys. Will you pray? And you know what he did? 4 hours later, he was up and he prayed at the bedside of both my boys. But anyway, I was worried. So I had one guy in St. Mary's and one in the other hospital, you know, the Methodist hospital. Boy, and I was in both chapels. I wasn't choosing up any side. Whenever I was praying. So I was in there and I said to Matt, I said, Matt, I'm worried. Now I said, I'm not making a deal with you. I know I'm not going to drink. And I didn't think I was going to drink. I know I wouldn't drink. But I said, I'm worried about my guys. Now I said, can you intercede for me and have me have that same confidence that my boys will be all right? And just like that, I had no more worry. Now that sound you may call that Fauci's flash or this, I don't care what you call it, but that's the fact, see. That's the way it worked. Now Matt was the biggest drunk in all Ireland. And boy, that's quite a reputation to have, see. But he quit drinking, and he died one day. He was an ordinary guy. He was a dock walloper, see. Died one day in the streets of Dublin. And then when they took his body to the morgue and prepared for burial, they found how he quit drinking. Embedded in his flesh was his hair shirt and chains and so on, all festered in there. That's the way he quit drinking. Boy, what a great AA he would have made, see? What a great AA. But we don't have to do that. All we have to do is ask the help of the power greater than ourselves to take us through this day. And you've got to believe it. But if you do believe it, he'll do it. And of course, you'll live to have many, many happy days in AA. And now the time is up, and I know you guys don't go any longer than we do. The hour is up. So I thought it'd be kind of nice to end this thing with an Irish blessing. And may the light shine out of the two eyes of you like a candle set in two windows of a house, bidding the wanderer to come in out of the storm. May the blessed sunshine shine on you and warm your heart till it glows like a great peat fire, so that the stranger may come in and warm himself at it, and also a friend. And may the blessing of the earth be on you, the great round earth. May you ever have a kindly greeting for them you pass as you're going along the roads. And may the blessing of the rain be on you, the soft, sweet rain. May it fall upon your spirit so that all the little flowers may spring up and shed their sweetness on the air. And may the blessing of the great rains be on you. May they beat upon your spirit and wash it fair and clean, and leave there many a shining pool where the blue of heaven shines and sometimes a star. May the earth be soft under you when you rest upon it, tired at the end of the day. And may it rest easy over you when at the last you lay out under it. May it rest so lightly over you that your soul may be out from under it quickly, and up and off and on its way to God. Thank you, Pastor.